The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from The Week magazine edition, dated November 25th, 2011. First, we'll begin with the main story section here. The article is entitled, Supreme Court to Rule on Obama's Health Plan. What happened? The Supreme Court agreed this week to hear a constitutional challenge to President Obama's health care reform law just months before the 2012 election. Oral arguments will likely be held in March, and the justices are expected to make a final decision by June. The core issue facing the court will be the constitutionality of the law's centerpiece, the requirement that every American buy health insurance starting in 2014 or face a fine. The administration argues that the mandate is authorized by the Commerce Clause, which allows the federal government to regulate economic activity related to interstate commerce. We know the Affordable Care Act is constitutional and are confident the Supreme Court will agree, said White House spokesman Dan Pfeiffer. The lawsuit brought by 26 states and the National Federation of Independent Business, however, claims the Commerce Clause does not give the government authority to force individuals to buy private products like health insurance. In both public surveys and at the ballot box, Americans have rejected the law's mandate, said Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. I hope the Supreme Court will do the same. Now here's what the editorials had to say. This will be the most politically freighted decision the court has faced since Bush versus Gore in 2000, said the New York New Jersey Star-Ledger. The Affordable Care Act provides coverage to the 50 million Americans who currently are uninsured. The mandate is necessary because the ACA bans insurers from refusing applicants with pre-existing conditions. If the court strikes down the individual mandate, freeloaders could wait until illness strikes, then buy a policy to cover their bills, causing health care reform to collapse and premiums to soar. This case is about more than health care, said the Wall Street Journal. If the justices rule that the individual mandate is constitutional, then the government would be free to order citizens to buy anything it deems good for them. And make no mistake, future governments would order specific commercial activity under this authority. They could demand, for instance, that citizens buy broccoli or domestic cars. The Supreme Court must strike down this gross overreach of federal power before it's too late. Now here's what the commentators had to say. The signs look good for an Obama win, said Massimo Calabresi in Time.com. In an appeals court decision that upheld the mandate last week, Judge Lawrence Silberman, a Reagan appointee, wrote that Congress must be free to forge national solutions to national problems. That followed an equally devastating opinion by another conservative federal appeals court judge, former Antonin Scalia clerk Jeffrey Sutton, who wrote that health care has few, if any, parallels in modern life, and that the federal government's attempts to extend coverage should not be impeded by the courts. There's also a clear legal precedent for compelling people to buy health insurance, said Einar Elhag in the New York Times. Check your pay stub and you'll see that money has been deducted for Medicare, whether or not you wanted to join that particular government health insurance scheme. I wouldn't be so confident, said Grace Marie Turner in NationalReview.com. When a federal appeals court in Florida ruled against the mandate in August, it said it could find no precedent for a mandate on individuals to purchase government-approved health insurance. Even during national emergencies, such as the Great Depression and World War II, the court noted, Congress had never ordered Americans to buy particular products like wheat or war bonds. History and the law stands against Obamacare. Whatever the Supreme Court decides, it will have a big impact on the 2012 election, said Chris Saliza in the Washington Post. If the court throws out the individual mandate, Republicans will get a big boost in their effort to persuade independent voters that Obama is an extremist who has engaged in egregious overreach. But if the justices affirm the law's constitutionality, it's the GOP that will look extremist. The health care law has come to define the first term of Obama's presidency. It could now play a deciding role in whether he wins a second term. The next item from the main story section of the Week magazine, GOP mulls a tax increase. House Republican leaders were trying last week to convince conservative lawmakers to accept a modest tax increase as the Congressional Supercommittee raced to cobble together a deficit reduction deal before its looming deadline. The bipartisan group must identify at least $1.2 trillion in savings by November 23rd or face triggering an automatic $1.2 trillion in cuts in domestic and defense spending. Republicans on the panel, who had opposed tax increases as part of a deficit reduction deal, proposed a compromise plan this week that would raise $250 billion in new revenue over the next decade by limiting deductions for upper-income households. In return, Democrats would accept more than $1 trillion in spending cuts and agree to lock in the Bush tax cuts beyond 2012 when they're ready or due to expire. For the deal to be approved, Republican leaders had to suppress a revolt from anti-tax conservatives in the House, while Democrats had to settle for much less than the $800 billion in new taxes that they proposed. And this article was, of course, written before what appeared to be the final failure of this committee this week. We'll have more details about that on next week's reading of the week. As we continue this article, at last, Grover Norquist's spell has been broken, said the New York Times in an editorial. The brass-knuckled president of Americans for Tax Reform wields enormous power in Washington, thanks to the simplistic pledge he extracts from nearly all Republican lawmakers to never, ever raise taxes. But some members of the GOP are finally acknowledging that the deficit cannot be closed without tax increases. The only allegiance they owe is to their constituents, not to Mr. Norquist. But the pledge exists for a reason, said Michael Tanner in NationalReview.com. Everyone knows if you give Democrats an inch on tax cuts, they'll take a mile and then spend whatever new revenues are raised. Besides, there's no need for compromise. If the supercommittee fails, is a perfectly adequate outcome in the $1.2 trillion in cuts guaranteed by the trigger mechanism. If failure means more budget cuts and less taxes, then bring it on. But now that both parties are retreating from their hardline positions, said J. Newton Small in Time.com, failure isn't inevitable. To forge something both parties can swallow, lawmakers may resort to the classic Washington maneuver of agreeing on a framework for spending cuts and tax reform, then punting the details down the road. With the supercommittee running out of time, the odds of compromise are edging up from zero. Again, I'll repeat, this is not written in the magazine this week, but this issue has been somewhat resolved, unfortunately, this week as members of the supercommittee have gone home for the Thanksgiving break and the deadline appears to be passed. So what will happen in this whole issue, we'll find out more next week. The next item in the Week magazine this week, Europe's galloping crisis. Italy named an unelected technocrat as prime minister this week, as Greece did last week, in hopes of convincing markets that deep economic reforms were finally underway to stem Europe's debt crisis. The selection of Mario Monti in Italy and Lucas Papademos in Greece, both economists with international experience, was initially greeted with cautious optimism. But when new data were released suggesting that the Eurozone's economy could be headed for recession, Italy's borrowing costs rose again to an unsustainable 7%. More ominously, bond rates were also rising for Austria, the Netherlands, Finland, and France, countries once considered safe from the crisis. The Eurozone mess is escalating dangerously, said the economist, and it's time to act. Italy suffers more from a lack of market confidence than insolvency. Its debt, though high, is stable. The European Central Bank must relieve the pressure by buying lots of Italian debt, despite Germany's worries that such action would allow Italy and others in the future to avoid enacting painful measures like tax hikes and pension reforms. Whatever the Europeans do, they need to act fast before this crisis jumps the Atlantic, said Reina Furrar in Time. We might have coped with a Greek default, but the fall of Italy, the world's eighth-largest economy, would be devastating for the U.S. Not only are Italy's biggest companies likely held by your pension fund, but U.S. banks own or are exposed to a good chunk of Italian debt. Italy's default would lead to a bigger credit crunch than the fall of Lehman Brothers did, and a global financial crisis that could tank the world economy. A crisis in small peripheral countries has become a conflagration, said Martin Wolf in the Financial Times. With borrowing costs now soaring even in the heart of the continent, EU leaders are facing perhaps their last chance to put out the fire. Let's hope they finally grasp that European unity, the global banking system, and the world economy depend on their next steps. And the next item from the Week magazine, the controversy of the week, Penn State. Why didn't anyone intervene? How could people let this happen, said Joel Achenbach in WashingtonPost.com. We don't yet know the full scale of the horror allegedly inflicted by former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky, who was charged last week with using his charitable Second Mile Foundation to sexually abuse 8 boys. But with reports this week of another 10 victims coming forward, there is a sickening sense that we've just begun to scratch the surface of a monstrous scandal. What we already know is damning, said Bob Ford in the Philadelphia Inquirer. As far back as 1998, the mother of one boy reported Sandusky, then to the team's defensive coordinator, to university police for groping her son in a shower. Sandusky was allowed to retire shortly thereafter. In 2000, a Penn State janitor reported seeing Sandusky, who still had access to the locker room, performing oral sex on a boy. In 2002, assistant coach Mike McQuarrie told a grand jury he caught Sandusky anally raping a 10-year-old in the showers. He then reported what he'd seen to legendary football coach Joe Paterno. Paterno, who is 84, has now been fired, as have Penn State's president and athletic director. But the question remains, did Paterno and Penn State know more than a decade what Sandusky was doing to boys he was supposedly mentoring, but chose to keep the lid on because this was a story that could look bad for everyone? If this all sounds a lot like the Catholic Church's pedophile scandal, said Margaret Wente in the Toronto Globe and Mail, it's for a good reason. College football is a true religion of America, and like the church, it's a bastion of male power, wealth, and hypocrisy. Paterno's Nittany Lions made a profit of $18.5 million last year on revenues of $106 million, thanks to 100,000 fans attending every home game. At the State College campus, Joe Pa is a sainted father figure, which is why Penn State has already turned him into a bronze statue outside the stadium. That statue tells us why, when Penn State employees saw nauseating scenes in the school showers, the powers at the top decided to protect the brand rather than the kids. Let's not get too sanctimonious, said David Brooks in the New York Times. It's easy to tell ourselves that if we'd been in Paterno's shoes or McQuarrie's, we would have turned our good friend Sandusky over to the cops. The uncomfortable truth, however, is that throughout history of human evil, from the Holocaust to Abu Ghraib to Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme, only a handful of people ever try to intervene, while the vast majority find ways to deceive themselves about what's happening. Otherwise, virtuous people are particularly susceptible to this willful blindness, said Ross Dutat, also in the Times. Paterno may have felt that because he'd done so much good over his 46-year career, he somehow had higher responsibilities than the ordinary run of humankind. But not even a lifetime of service to others can make up for leaving a single child alone, abandoned to evil, weeping in the dark. So let there be no excuses, said Charles Pierce in Grantland.com, and no sympathy for Paterno or anyone else complicit in destroying young boys' lives. Those who said nothing deserve what's coming to them in the criminal and civil proceedings to come. There's nothing that can happen to the university or to the people sunk up to their eyeballs in this incredible moral quagmire that's worse than what happened to the children who got raped. Now let's turn to the popular column in the Week magazine called The Good Week For and The Bad Week For. Always entertaining. It was a good week for packing earphones after Ryanair, the no-frills British airline, said it was considering a plan to let passengers watch pornography in flight on handheld devices. It was a good week for potholes after a Cincinnati woman driving her choking 8-year-old daughter to the hospital hit a deep rut, dislodging the locket stuck in the girl's throat and saving her life. "Oh, Mom, I feel better. I don't feel it anymore," said Lacey Davis after the locket dropped down to her stomach. It was a good week for beer drinkers after researchers in Italy found that drinking 1 to 2 pints of beer per day has the same cardiovascular benefits as red wine, which can lower the risk of heart disease by 31%. It was a bad week for Abraham Lincoln after a copper sword held by the statue of a Civil War soldier atop Lincoln's tomb in Springfield, Illinois, was stolen and likely sold for scrap. The cemetery recently eliminated its overnight security guard because of budget cuts. It was a bad week for anthropomorphizing after a South African man was savagely chewed to death by 2,400-pound hippopotamus he kept as a pet. "Humphrey's like a son to me. He's just like a human," Marius Ells, 40, had insisted. And it was a bad week for whoever sold the van after Charles Preston of San Jose, California, discovered $500,000 worth of cocaine hidden in a used minivan he purchased for $14,000 last year. He quickly called police, who told him, "You're so lucky, you'd be in jail for the rest of your life if you got searched in a traffic stop and they found this." Now let's turn to the People section in the Week magazine. Our first item this week is entitled Shatner's Faith in Marriage. "William Shatner has always been a ladies' man," said Mickey Rapkin in Elle magazine. At 12, he lost his virginity to a woman who helped the families cook. She stopped cooking breakfast and cooked me for a while," he says. His early encounters weren't entirely successful. "It's a lot of flopping around until you know where things are supposed to be." Shatner got the chance to perfect his technique after winning the role of Captain James T. Kirk in the Star Trek TV series. But he soon tired of betting women who wanted to be with the captain of the Enterprise, not William Shatner. "The longer I go about living, I see it's the relationship that is most meaningful," he says. "Sex without the relationship is cold and unappetizing. It's a Chinese meal the day after. You gotta throw it out." After 2 divorces, he found love again in 1997 when he married former model Nareen Kidd. But 2 years later, his beautiful soulmate, who had long battled with alcoholism, drowned in their family pool. Despite this tragedy, Shatner's faith in marriage hadn't been shaken, and in 2001 he wed his 4th wife, Elizabeth Martin. "I love being married," he says. "It's being in soul with another human being. It's like that Watson Crick DNA, the circular staircase of entwinement." The next item from the People section is Burton's Angry Widow. "Don't mention the name Elizabeth Taylor to Sally Burton," said Christopher Wilson in the London Telegraph. In the 27 years since the death of her husband, actor Richard Burton, Sally has grown sick of hearing Taylor described as the love of his life. I get pissed off with all the talk of a great love story, says Burton's fourth and final wife. Yes, they were in love, but they got divorced twice. That means their marriage didn't work. Sally, who is 63, is especially angered by claims made in a recent book that Burton wrote a love letter to Taylor on his deathbed. There was no letter, she says, and she should know she was nursing Burton when he died of a brain hemorrhage in 1984. Sally believes the writers made up the letter, which has never been seen in public, to help sell their book. The public knows what's going on. Sally finds these efforts to hype Burton's romance with Taylor all the more painful, because while Taylor married twice more than after Burton, Sally stayed single. Burton was her one and only. I found it difficult, but the world hasn't realized that, and I just don't know why, she says, her voice trailing away in a wave of emotion. My love for him has never diminished. And the next item from the People section of the week, Madonna's never-ending rebellion. Madonna is still at war with people's expectations, said Naomi Wolf in Harper's Bazaar. Growing up in an Italian Catholic family in Michigan, she resented the fact that her brothers were allowed to run wild while she had to dress and behave demurely. We were told to wear our skirts to our knees and not do anything that would draw attention, she says. One of my father's famous quotes was, "If there were more virgins, the world would be a better place." In high school, she rebelled. "I saw how girls had to behave to get the boys," says the 53-year-old, "so I decided to do the opposite. I refused to wear makeup, have a hairstyle, shave my armpits." Her rebellion marked her as an outsider. "Boys in my school call me Hairy Monster." 4 decades later, what rankles Madonna is ageism. "Whenever someone writes about me, my age is right after my name," she says. "They're saying, here she is, but remember, she's this age, so she's not relevant anymore." But Madonna plans to keep acting outrageously. "I'll continue to do what we perceive as the realm of young people, to provoke and to be rebellious." Now we'll turn to the briefing section of the Week magazine for this week, and this particular article is entitled "The Rise and Fall of Il Cavaliere." The era of Silvio Berlusconi, Italy's longest-serving post-war prime minister, is finally over. Will Italy ever recover? How did he get to the top? By leveraging a roguish charm and a gift for demagoguery with great wealth and influence, Berlusconi started out his career as a crooner on cruise ships before getting a law degree and starting a local cable TV company. He eventually grew that company into Italy's biggest media empire. Along the way, he bought a soccer team, AC Milan, and then founded a political party he called Forza Italia. Go Italy, after a popular fan chant for the national team. When vast bribery scandals in the early 1990s swept away the parties that had dominated the country's politics, many Italians saw Berlusconi as the perfect antidote to corruption, an independent billionaire businessman who couldn't be bought. But his first stint as prime minister, beginning in May 1994, lasted less than a year before he was hit with fraud charges, too. That was just the first of dozens of scandals that have marked his career. What has he been accused of? Well, even before being elected to his second term as prime minister in 2001, Berlusconi was under investigation for money laundering, association with the mafia, tax evasion, and bribing judges and financial regulators. Once in office, he applied pressure to downgrade charges and even to rewrite laws he'd violated. He avoided punishment for using an illegal slush fund to buy a soccer star for AC Milan. For example, by pushing through a 2002 law partly decriminalizing false accounting. Berlusconi has long maintained that he is being picked on by leftist prosecutors. "I am the Jesus Christ of politics," he once said. "I'm the most legally persecuted man of all times." He also claims political enemies have tried to create scandals out of his healthy interest in women. How many scandals have there been? Well, too many to count. It's better to like beautiful girls than to be gay, Berlusconi once declared. He is notorious for appointing models and showgirls and even his dental hygienist to political positions and for staging orgies at his various villas. 2 years ago, his second wife filed for divorce after he began spending time with an 18-year-old girl who called him Pappy or Daddy. After that came revelations of his bunga bunga parties, which he apparently adopted from his pal, the late Libyan dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi. Witnesses said bunga bungas featured Berlusconi sitting on a throne-like chair as young women dressed in nurse and police uniforms stripped and danced around him. Berlusconi would then allegedly select a few winners to join him in bed. He's now awaiting trial on charges that he paid for sex with an underage prostitute, Karima El Maroug, and then tried to get her off of a subsequent theft charge by falsely telling police the case would cause a diplomatic rift with Egypt. Why did Italy keep electing him? As embarrassing as Berlusconi has been to Italy's elites, he retained the grudging admiration of many working-class Italians, who identified with his love of soccer, envied his sex life, and saw him as an authentic man of the people. The average Italian saw himself as Berlusconi, only poorer, newspaper columnist Massimo Gramellini told the New York Times. Berlusconi, whose nickname Il Cavaliere means the knight, further secured his power by buying the loyalty of other politicians and power brokers. The system he has built has the features of a lordly court. A signore sits at the center, surrounded by a large number of courtesans and servants who owe him their power, their wealth, and their fame, said Princeton political cartoonist Maurizio Veroli. And as Italy's biggest media tycoon, Berlusconi was able to suppress unfavorable news and comment. He owns three national TV networks, a major newspaper, a top news magazine, a publishing house, and the country's largest media buyer. As prime minister, he also had indirect control over state television and radio. Last year, wiretaps caught him chewing out a state broadcasting regulator for airing shows examining his alleged mafia links. You might expect this kind of media concentration in Turkmenistan or Iran, said Domenico Affinito of Reporters Without Borders, but it shouldn't take place in a country like Italy. Is Italy's dire economy his fault? To some extent, but mostly because of what he didn't do. In 2001, Berlusconi inherited an economy crying out for reform. The tax system was a mess, tax evasion was rampant, and the welfare system was unsustainable. But he ignored the economy to concentrate on passing laws that favored his media empire and protected him from prosecution. Productivity fell, but wages remained high. Italy's GDP began to drop, and the budget deficit and national debt ballooned. By this year, Italy ranked below Belarus and Mongolia in the World Bank's Business Index. Yet even this summer, in preparing an austerity budget desperately needed to stave off crisis, Berlusconi tried to slip in a measure that would have let defendants avoid paying court order settlements for years, saving his company hundreds of millions of dollars. As journalist Curzio Maltese puts it, Berlusconi never fails to live up to our worst expectations. And now the footnote from this briefing section, the charges he still faces. Out of office now, Berlusconi faces three trials he no longer has the means to evade. The biggest is the Maroug case, in which he's accused of sex with an underage prostitute and abuse of power. Berlusconi didn't manage to pass a law limiting the use of wiretaps, which would have rendered inadmissible some of the more sordid evidence, including phone conversations in which he talks of doing eight girls. Then there's the charge that he bribed his former lawyer with $600,000 to perjure himself in court. Berlusconi tried to pass a law shortening the statute of limitations so that case would be thrown out. A third case involves tax fraud and false accounting in his company, Mediaset. Still, the 75-year-old needn't worry. In his previous term, he passed a law allowing most criminals over 70 to avoid jail time. And now let's turn to the best columns from the Week magazine for this week in the United States. Our first one is entitled The GOP's Search for Conan by Michael Medved in the DailyBeast.com. Why does Mitt Romney inspire such angry contempt among my fellow conservatives? Asked Michael Medved. They'll tell you it's because he's a gutless, unprincipled moderate, but the real reason is more troubling. Romney doesn't just reflect the rage and paranoia that have deformed the GOP since Barack Obama's election. In 2008, the former Massachusetts governor won the support of Rush Limbaugh and almost every other talk radio conservative. Laura Ingraham even called Romney a conservative's conservative. Since then, Romney has only solidified his conservative credentials. So why the stubborn refusal to accept him as the party's best candidate? It's a matter of style. Romney is cool and collected, reasonable and restrained, while the right wants a nominee who embodies its fury and disgust. After 3 years of Obama's self-infatuated grandiosity, conservatives long for the political equivalent of Conan the Barbarian, an avenger who will lay waste to Obama and the liberal agenda once and for all. Obviously, Romney is no Conan, but if you're looking for a president, isn't a pragmatic problem solver better than incoherent rage? The next column is entitled, What Teens Don't Know About Google. And this was written by Clive Thompson in Wired.com. Young people are supposedly our most web-literate citizens, said Clive Thompson, but just how savvy are they? Not very. They simply swallow whatever they find on Google. To study kids' online search skills, scientific researchers asked a group of students to look up answers to a series of questions. Not surprisingly, the kids relied on web pages at the top of Google's results list. When researchers switched the order of results, most students were easily tricked and relied on the falsely top-ranked pages. Other studies have also shown that students really don't bother trying to assess the credibility of information found online. Is an article a disguised advertisement? Was that profile of Martin Luther King Jr. actually posted by white supremacists? The average high school and college student is unable to discern the hidden agendas. The naivete is largely the fault of schools, which rarely teach critical thinking. And mastering crap detection 101 isn't easy. You need to be savvy about the world and how it works. Ultimately, a broad-based education is the only true key to effective search. And the next column is entitled Privacy Dies with a Whimper by Jonathan Turley in The Washington Post. How much privacy should Americans expect? Asked Jonathan Turley. The answer to that question may determine whether the government will soon have the right to track you 24 hours a day without a warrant. Under current law, the government needs a warrant to conduct any kind of surveillance that intrudes on a citizen's reasonable expectation of privacy. But in a new case before the Supreme Court, the Obama administration last week argued that police should not be required to get a warrant to affix a GPS tracker to your car to see if you're involved in crimes. When driving, you really can't expect any privacy, can you? It may sound Orwellian, but GPS tracking is just the next step in the rapid erosion of privacy that followed 9/11. Out of its fear of terrorism, the public has accepted airport pat-downs, surveillance of phone calls and emails, and constant monitoring by TV cameras in public places and offices. In this brave new world, we think Big Brother makes us safer, so don't be surprised when privacy disappears altogether. The problem is not with the government, but with us. You're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we will flip to the back of the magazine to the last word. And the article this week is entitled The Faces of Early Man. The Kennis twins will change the way we see our ancestors, says Stephanie Marsh if we're not afraid to look. It is unlikely that you know what a paleo artist is. Furthermore, unless you are either an anthropologist or that rare breed of subscriber to the National Geographic who actually gets around to reading the magazine, it is even less likely that you care. But you should, if only because it's a field completely ridden with interesting controversies. Take one example. The first Neanderthal remains were discovered in Germany in the mid-19th century. For years after that, the general public assumed these creatures were thick, hairy, bull-necked folk who walked about the earth on bent knees, only said "ugh," and brandished crudely hewn stone clubs. Now it transpires, after much more research, DNA evidence, and so on, that Neanderthals had brains bigger than ours, although with smaller frontal lobes, were not covered in fur, were probably capable of speech, and carved intricate tools, many of which survive today. The notion that they walked around on bent chimpanzee knees, it transpires, derives wholly from the fact that one of the first Neanderthal skeletons ever discovered had dodgy knees, a defect that scientists were later able to attribute to a bad case of arthritis. And though it is scientists who make these discoveries, it is paleoartists who have, over the years, interpreted them for our benefit in the form of drawings, paintings, and three-dimensional anthropological models. I admit that my heart sank at the thought of traveling to an unremarkable city in the Netherlands to interview identical twins, Alphonse and Audrey Kennis. The phrase "two of the world's most accomplished paleo artists" hardly makes one want to leap onto the next flight to Arnhem. But as soon as I reach their offices, where Alphonse flings open the door and begins jabbering away with his brother, I am won over. The 44-year-old brothers tear up the stairs into a room in which shelves creak under the weight of the skulls of at least 70 mammals, living and extinct. Images of tribes from around the world with their adornments, weather-beaten features, and missing teeth inform all of their reconstructions. The brothers pore over coffee table books, enthusing over, say, the particular beauty of droopy, asymmetrical breasts on the tribal women of South America, or the nobility of the deeply wrinkled skin of Mongolian tribesmen. I don't know how they can stay so worked up, but their obsession is genuine. They've modeled around 30 heads and 6 or so full bodies and only work with casts of real skulls. The KNM-ER 1813 skull from Lake Turkana, Kenya, one of the most complete Homo habilis skulls ever found and dated back to 1.85 million years ago. The old man of La Chapelle aux Saints à Neanderthal, who lived around 60,000 years ago. Wilma, the female Neanderthal, built using replicas of a pelvis and cranial anatomy from Neanderthal females. Do they consider themselves artists? No, we are no artists, says one of the or the other. To be honest, they sound identical on tape. Are they rich? No, they laugh in unison. Look, says either Alphonse or Audrey, pointing at one of their reconstructions, we use the hair of a Scottish Highlander. The hair is russet-colored and has been implanted in the head of a silicon-faced Neanderthal. What kind of Scottish men donate their hair to the paleoartistry industry? A cow, screamed the Kennises. The hair comes from Highland cattle. The Kennises have caused some ripples in the museum world. Paleo artists are as susceptible to any of us to their own imagination. Artists, even scientific professors, can romanticize the past like everyone else, says Alphonse. Hence, what you'll see depicted as an early example of Homo erectus in museums, in books, or on television is often wildly inaccurate, as influenced by fantasy or fashion as anything in a glossy magazine. You'll see prehistoric humans depicted with gleaming white teeth or smooth, pale skin. People have fantasies about what it's like to live most of your life in the outdoors, said Alphonse. It's a hard life. The Kennises don't do smooth. They don't do expressionless either. If the bones show that a prehistoric human incurred an injury to his jaw that would give him a tooth infection, this is what the Kennesses will imply in the face of their reconstruction. There are stories of nervous curators balking at the Kennesses' version of Otzi, the Iceman, hunch-shouldered, wizened with an underbite. A previous paleoartist had shown Otzi, who was a mummified man. He was discovered on the Italian-Austrian border in 1991. He is 5,300 years old, as youthful and handsome, and the museum curator from Germany had hoped for something similar, preferably with blue eyes and a six-pack, a sort of Aryan folk hero. But unfortunately for the German curator, the people that most resemble prehistoric man are tramps, say the Kennesses. We tend to glamorize our ancestors, they say. We like to think our forebears, if they are male, look something like Arnold Schwarzenegger. If they are female, we imagine them to have long, flowing Pocahontas hair, despite the proven absence of combs until comparatively recently. In the 1990s, the trend of paleoartists glamorizing their reconstructions reached a peak. Paleoartists were creating replicas that looked like they just stepped out of the shower, fumes Audrey. They made their noses too small, too pretty. They also gave them too many clothes. Nudity is a sensitive subject, even in natural history museums. When the Kennesses made Wilma, a four-foot-something Neanderthal named after Fred Flintstone's wife, there were scientists who wanted to preserve her modesty beneath clothes. One curator told the Kennesses that Muslim children wouldn't be allowed to go into the museum because they're not allowed to see naked women. The Kennesses argued that Neanderthals were more likely to be naked, and therefore caving in to religious sensitivity would be a distortion of the truth. Is there a sense that museums distort history because of their fears about how people will react? "Yah, yah," screamed the brothers in joyful and sorrowful recognition. Pendulous, asymmetrical breasts may be beautiful to their Dutch creators, but to a public more used to the pert, full versions on billboards and magazines, they are ugly and obscene. "Too many people look at the past through Western glasses," said Alphonse. "We think our ancestors will look like us." When they were teenagers, the twins filled up their parents' shed with the skulls of dead animals. They began to read obsessively about skulls. This was a godsend, they say, because they were terrible in school. If it hadn't been for skulls, they probably wouldn't have ever picked up a book. Nevertheless, their prospects were not rosy, and they may well have foundered as art teachers had they not been sidetracked by the author of a children's book on prehistoric animals, who asked them to illustrate it. Being the Kennesses, they decided this would be impossible unless they first constructed three-dimensional models of the creatures they were to draw, to see where the light falls. Commissions from National Geographic soon followed. In the late 90s, they persuaded an Italian scientist to lend them a cast of one of the Sacco Pastore skulls, fossilized hominid skulls that had been found by the Anian River in Lazio, Italy in 1929, and that are judged to be between 70,000 and 100,000 years old. The head they made is now on an unknown shelf somewhere in Rome. The techniques they use now are as much more sophisticated, the twins say. The Kennesses are obsessed, eccentric, serious pioneers. One hopes that, in the end, they will win over the anxious curators and their worries about prudish visitors. A survey taken in Balzano, Italy, where you can see the Kennesses' reconstruction of Otzi, found that most people like to think of their ancestors as good-looking, noble people with perfect skin, rather like film stars. "The reality is," say the Kennesses, "that we look like homeless people. Then again, Otzi does rather look like a film star, I thought. He's a dead ringer for Nick Nolte and Down and Out in Beverly Hills." And the top of this article here shows drawings by the Kennesses, the Kennes twins that we're talking about here, beginning with one called Australopithecus afarensis, which was a southern ape from a far region. It's thought that this particular character could be the ancestor of the genus Homo, to which modern human beings belong, Homo sapiens, that is. And this particular ancestor dates back to 3.9 million to 2.9 million years ago. The next one is an African southern ape, which was one of the first early hominid species to be identified. Its discovery proved that ancient hominids evolved in Africa, and that despite small brains, they walked upright. This particular character lived from 3.3 million to 2.1 million years ago. Then there was the Homo habilis, which is called the handyman, and he got his name because some of the fossils are associated with early tools, the first member of the genus Homo that appears in the fossil record. And that one goes back to 2.4 million to 1.6 million years old. There's a progression of a few other caricatures, I guess you would say, or creations by the Kenneth twins here, leading up to the most recent one, which is Homo sapiens, wise man. After more than 7 million years of hominid evolution, Homo sapiens, our species, developed a diversified tool set and spread out from Africa to take over the planet. And the scientific estimation of when that happened was approximately 200,000 years ago. The Faces of Early Man from the London Times, and it's copyrighted by the Times Magazine. All rights are reserved, and we read it with permission. Now we'll continue with our reading from the Week magazine this week with the Talking Points section. The first item from this section is Gingrich, the latest non-Romney. 3 months ago, Newt Gingrich looked like roadkill, said John Cassidy in The New Yorker. His Republican presidential campaign had imploded, his staff had walked out en masse, and everyone was writing his political epitaph. But now the mouth of the South is back, with Herman Cain, Rick Perry, and the other conservative alternatives to Mitt Romney self-destructing. A new CNN survey this week showed support for Gingrich soaring from the single digits to 22%, only 2% behind Romney. Several other polls also now have the former House Speaker from Georgia surging to second in the race, with Cain fading. We've seen plenty of these mini surges in this strange campaign, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. But if Gingrich is able to truly challenge Romney for the nomination, his story will surpass Richard Nixon's as the most improbable political comeback in modern American politics. It simply isn't going to happen, said Michael Tomosky in DailyBeast.com. Because the guy has more baggage than a Stones tour. Gingrich, who's been married 3 times, served divorce papers to his first wife while he was being treated for cancer, and he was conducting an affair while trying to impeach Bill Clinton for lying about infidelity. As House Speaker, Gingrich shut down the government in 1995, causing a huge backlash against the GOP. He has a long history of reckless rhetoric and has flip-flopped as shamelessly as Romney on issues from climate change to health care reform. And then there's the small matter of Gingrich's personality, said Gene Healy in WashingtonExaminer.com. Condescending, pompous, and self-important, he speaks with the grandiloquence of a Ph.D. historian. But there's a zany Cliff Clavin aspect to his pronouncements. At times he comes off sounding like a guy who read way too much during a long prison stretch. Still don't write Gingrich off, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. The hour is late and the pickings are slim. Many conservatives still can't stomach Romney, and Gingrich's strengths match the moment. In the Republican debates, Gingrich has mastered the art of sounding like a disgusted populist outsider itching to put an end to Washington shenanigans. He also consistently displays a prickly hostility to the media, which always scores points with conservative voters. If Romney fails to close the deal in coming weeks, many Republican voters may decide that you have to go to a political war with the alternative that you have. In a related article, the next item is entitled The Voters' Mood, a Hint for 2012. Voters have sent Republicans a very distinct message, said E.J. Dion in the Washington Post. They've had enough of a conservative overreach. In last week's off-year elections, voters in Ohio repealed Governor John Kasich's anti-labor bill to strip public sector unions of their collective bargaining rights. Mississippi voted down a personhood amendment that would have given fertilized human eggs the same rights as people. And in Arizona, a state Senate president who spearheaded viciously anti-immigrant legislation was successfully recalled. Clearly, middle-class, middle-of-the-road Americans think the GOP has swung way too far to the right. What conservative activists don't understand, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com, is that even mainstream Republican voters don't share their disdain for government. Voters are only opposed to government programs that seem to benefit people other than themselves. That's why Ohio voters stood up for the bargaining rights for people like us, the cops, firefighters, and nurses who live alongside them and provide them services. But the election also produced some good signs for conservatives, said John Hood in NationalReview.com. Republicans gained control of the Senate in Virginia, a key battleground state in next year's presidential elections, and successfully passed over ID laws in Mississippi. And in a serious blow to President Obama, Ohio voters overwhelmingly approved a symbolic measure opposing the mandates of his Affordable Care Act. That suggests it's not just conservative overreach that voters are unhappy with, said Danny Yadron in the Wall Street Journal. It's overreach in general. The message to both parties is unmistakable. Government needs to back off. And so we have equipoise, said Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. The great pendulum swing of the 2010 midterm elections is now reversing itself, and with a year to go before the presidential election, things can break either way. The wildly varied results of these elections serve as a reminder that American voters are thoughtful and discriminating, and not mindlessly partisan. For Republicans, this means there is no coasting to victory, 9% unemployment or not. Their presidential candidate had better be a serious candidate with a command of the issues, not a demagogic populist. If the GOP doesn't heed that warning, 2012 will be a struggle. The next item from Talking Points is Keystone Pipeline, an Obama cop-out? President Obama claims to care about creating jobs, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, but the only job he seems to care about is his own. That's why he decided last week to postpone until 2013 a ruling on the $7 billion Keystone XL oil pipeline, which would have produced 20,000 jobs for U.S. workers. The administration claims the delay is needed to examine the environmental impact of the 1,700-mile pipeline, which would carry 900,000 barrels of crude a day from Canada's tar sands deposits to Texas refineries. But this Keystone cop-out has nothing to do with the environment. Obama punted this decision until after the 2012 election because he wants to retain the support of big green campaign donors who threatened to desert him if the project were approved. Once again, this president has demonstrated his central flaw, weakness under pressure, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Whenever there's a controversy, he chooses to kick the can down the road. Obama showed true leadership by saying no to big oil, said independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in the London Guardian. This project would have pumped vast amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, as tar sands must be crushed, steamed, and diluted in water before they release oil, a process that uses far more energy than conventional oil production. And piping corrosive tar sands is risky. The original route proposed by oil giant TransCanada would have passed over Nebraska's Ogallala Aquifer, which provides drinking water to 1.5 million people. TransCanada now says it would divert the pipeline around the aquifer should it ever get the go-ahead. And insider trading for Congress. It's legal. In the early days of 2008's financial crisis, U.S. Representative Spencer Backus, a Republican from Alabama, attended a secret apocalyptic briefing by top federal officials who warned that Wall Street was about to crater. The next day, Backus invested $7,800 in an index fund that bet against the market and soon doubled his money. Bacchus, who made 40 or more trades while the economy melted down, is one of many members of Congress who are now under fire for stock and financial dealings that would appear to be based on insider information, said Mark Thiessen in WashingtonPost.com. As conservative scholar Peter Schweitzer details in an explosive new book, this shameless but entirely legal practice is widespread among both Democrats and Republicans. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and her husband invested millions in a preferential Visa IPO just as the House was killing a law that would hurt the credit card industry. Representative John Boehner bought health insurance stocks, knowing those stocks would rise in value when Republicans killed the health care bill's public option. Now a few short items as we reach the end of our program this week. Since the beginning of the Occupy Wall Street protest, published mentions of the term income inequality have increased more than fivefold. There were 500 instances of the term last week, according to a survey of print articles, web stories, and broadcast transcripts, compared with just 91 the week before the protests began. Taxpayers spend $800,000 a year to house each prisoner at Guantanamo Bay, 30 times what it costs to keep a prisoner on U.S. soil. And with the British government cutting back on financial support to the royal family, the royals are renting out portions of St. James Palace and Leeds Castle in Kent to corporations for next summer's Olympic Games in London. Prices start at $45,000 a day. Now let's look at the poll watch for this week. By a 79% to 9% margin, Americans say Penn State football coach Joe Paterno should have gone to the police when he learned of sexual assault allegations against his former assistant coach in 2002. And President Obama maintains a narrow 1.4% lead over Mitt Romney in an aggregation of seven polls. In these combined polls, Obama leads Herman Cain by 9%, Rick Perry by 9%, and Newt Gingrich by 10%. And we've run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, and I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.